to order.
Okay.
Can we get a roll call, please?
Yes. Commissioner Olbert?
Here.
Commissioner Lieberman?
Here.
Commissioner Aguirre?
Here.
Commissioner Audie?
Here.
Okay, please join me for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I believe we have some public comments, but these are on a different item, so we'll move on. There's no other, is there anyone else to speak on public comment that hasn't given part?
There is a 5A and a 5B.
Right, correct. That's what I said.
Yeah. No other ones besides those two.
All right. Moving on to 5A, safety moment. Do we take the speaker before or after?
I think after.
Okay.
Today's safety moment is on cover your cough, which is what we're hearing a lot about these days with the coronavirus, and it makes a lot of sense. Use tissues, throw them away afterwards if you don't have tissue available. Cough or sneeze into your arm, your elbow, that sort of thing. So and wash your hands frequently. I think we're hearing this message over and over and over again. So it's
kind of unfortunately.
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Lewis, would you like to address us on 5A?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Jim Lewis. The safety moment portion of your monthly Commission meeting agenda is primarily written for your benefit. However, I, too, find that very helpful, useful information. The reality of living today is we're challenged in many ways, including the potential for wildfires, earthquakes, sea level rise, and a host of other potential day-to-day events. The safety moment documents remind us of the importance to be mindful of our health and our safety for not only ourselves, but for our family, co-workers, and others. For some of us, however, we don't fully pay attention to a topic until the need arises. For that reason, I put together a recap for my own use, and today I share it with you. If I may direct your attention for a moment to the handouts provided earlier, you will find the first handout is a recap of the safety moments covered in the year 2019. The second handout is a recap of the past 4 years arranged by month. This may help you to find something in a hurry on one-page recap. The third page is a recap of the safety moments, but arranged alphabetically by topic. Silicon Valley Clean Water provides a valuable service to the community. What comes with it is the responsibility to provide a safe working environment. The safety moment at each of your meetings is an indication of the importance of that topic. The safety board on the wall is another indication of its importance. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Okay. 5B.
5B, I prepared a memo for the agenda packet. I got a call from and talked with a woman from Daughters of the American Revolution who had what I thought was a really good idea about putting a plaque on 1406 Radio Road to just note its historical significance. I also included article from the San Mateo Daily Journal as well as her email to me, and I wanted input direction from the commission if this is something you would be interested in doing. The plaque would have about 100 words on it. It's 18 by 24 inches wide by high and probably made out of brass rather than concrete. So Daughters of the American Revolution would generate the funding for it themselves, and then I would certainly want to be able to dictate where they place it on the building, and I have a pretty good idea about where it should be placed, but again, wanted to get input from the commission and if you think it's a good idea.
So just a little background. In the city of Redwood City does a lot with its historical society, historical archives, looking for homes and businesses and so on to really acknowledge the history of Redwood City. And so they reached out to myself and to Teresa to see if we could do this. I think it would be nice to have it as a PR for our organization. Can you tell me what goes on in that building? I mean, who's going to see it?
Well, the building's actually near a trail, a walking path, so there are people that come, especially since the article was published. Our construction manager, who is housed there now, it's our construction management offices, say there's a lot more people stopping in the parking lot and looking at the building, so I think we actually do get pretty good.
And what inside is so, just offices?
Just offices. Mm-hmm.
That are still active.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
I think it sounds like a very nice idea to pursue. The only, not so much caveat, but something I would be looking for from staff is an assessment of whether or not classifying it in this manner would raise risks of difficulty of operation. I can't imagine that it would, but that, to me, that's the question, just because the protection comes with it, you know, some constraints on what you can do.
Right.
And I don't necessarily object to accepting constraints, but I'd like to know what they are and make sure that we're all okay, particularly if you're okay, that, it's not going to be that big a deal.
Right. So this is twofold. One is the plaque, which has no restrictions.
Right.
It's just information. But the second portion of do we want to pursue it becoming a historical place, then it does have restrictions.
And that's
really we have to have
the plaque. The plaque sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Agree.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say similarly, the plaque's fine. It's I'd want to know what our long-term you know, usage of the building is and whether it's going to get it in the room, so to speak.
Yeah.
Not that we shouldn't override that, but we should at least consider it.
I'll do a little more research on it becoming a historical place and what constraints that places on.
I don't think it's much
more
than that.
Yeah. And I'll bring it back at some point to the commission. Thank you. That's all.
That's all on you.
Oh, the other part of my manager's report verbal is I just want to inform the commission that we are our emergency response planning for COVID-19 is ongoing. We're identifying essential personnel, et cetera, essential materials and supplies that we need and working with our vendors. So just wanted to assure you that we are having our response
in
place.
And thank you for mentioning that, because I heard about it. Ask about that. I wasn't sure when in the agenda we could ask questions like that. At this point, you don't see any potentially significant issues if on operations.
Not yet. We're tracking it daily. We have decided to cancel some of our group activities that we were going to have. Why risk it? But as far as people working remotely at this point, we're not requiring that. We are asking people to not attend. There's a lot of conferences that are happening in this month and early next month. Two of them have been canceled themselves, but we're suggesting that people don't go to this kind of trainings.
Just as a general question, and if it's a long answer, we can talk about it offline if other people are interested. But I hadn't thought about this before. Working in a waste treatment facility, does that expose people to a higher risk of pathogens just because that's one of the vectors through which things move?
Certainly we're exposed to a lot more pathogens than the normal public is. We've gone through a couple webinars on COVID-19 specifically, and there's not an increased risk from COVID-19 just because of how it's transmitted.
Right.
But, I mean, we kind of have a leg up because we're already used to, washing our hands all the time, wearing gloves, all that.
So because you have to.
Because we have to, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's all I have for my manager's report.
Okay. And I also have a speaker card on this one. Mr. Lewis.
Thank you. Ordinarily, I only speak on one item, but I was particularly moved with this one. As this year's president of the Menlo Park Historic Association, although today I'm speaking on my own behalf, I just wanted to emphasize my support for this proposal. Menlo Park has installed a number of plaques around town. They've not been damaged. In fact, we've gotten nothing but rave reviews for them. I'm familiar with them in Redwood City, and it is marvelous, particularly in the downtown area. And so once any concerns are overcome, it's my hope that you proceed in installing it. It was not only in the Daily Journal newspaper, as a staff report indicated, in the Climate magazine. It was also mentioned in the Daily Post. And I brought along a copy of that article, which perhaps can be circulated amongst the four of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Okay, no financial reports.
The financial reports are shown as ordinary amounts. I have no further comments unless the commission has questions.
Any questions on 5C and the investment report? Just an update on investment report, correct?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, so now we'll move on. The engineering project status update.
It's a written report. I have nothing further unless there are questions.
And the commission requested staff level action items.
Yeah, nothing else to report beyond what's in the written report.
And the rescue design build status update.
Similarly, that's a written report. No presentation.
Good. So matters of commission members' interest. Hearing none, we move on. Consent agenda. Any questions on the consent agenda?
Yes, through the chair. I had questions on D and E.
Okay, let's take those before we move.
On D, just a quick question, which I think I can answer for you. Were there any changes included in the text that was approved by the county?
No changes.
So basically, it flips out. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, do you want me to do
yes,
E as
please.
Well? Mm-hmm. On E, my question on E, and I know I keep asking these things, is so on the back, the second page talks about total authorization is $20 million fixed within the budget. The question I always have on these things is how does it compare to what we had expected earlier? In other words, is it coming in on track with when we're developing our plans, or is it mm-hmm. higher or lower? And I know they're always going to be different, but it's more like, is there a significant difference?
Right. I'll let Kim answer that.
It is different. It's not a significant difference. It's within the range of costs we considered when we were showing the risk register a couple months ago. We're within those limits on this element of the project. Yeah.
Okay. So. Thank you. For what it's worth, if there's and there's lots of ways of doing it, but if there's a way that's relatively straightforward for staff to view to sort of address that kind of thing.
Sure.
That mm-hmm. would be helpful for mm-hmm. me. I have every reason to believe that, you know, if there was a problem, you would tell us, but mm-hmm. it's,
sure.
it's particularly on a project with lots of moving parts and elements, it's easy for each individual thing to be just like a little bit out of whack.
Understood.
It's like, oh,
yep.
surprise, we have a problem.
Right.
So that's what I'm trying to get a feel yeah. for. Okay. That's the only questions I have.
And just in response to the finances, so this is kind of a work in progress. We are trying to get the finance section tailored to what the commission's looking for, so we'll try to fit that in somehow.
That's fine. And again, I don't mind asking the questions and giving the answers. It's just that's
yeah, but it'd be nice to have it in here. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Can I get a motion to approve the
move approval?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Dylan.
Okay. Moving on to item 8A.
Okay, this is Matt's item.
Item 8A, investment policy update. This is the third time we've discussed this, and I wanted to remind myself, you know, the
the original policy was written certainly prior to me being here. And not having the advantage of being here in the room, what I'm trying to do is offer some standardization as to what we see in other agencies. So what we did was we took the feedback from the commission. We did discuss with the staff. We certainly shared this information with staff in advance. The feedback was good. And I learned something that in prior discussions that I had with the staff back in October, I hadn't clarified one key point. And that is, what funds are we specifically talking about when we invest, you know, in this policy? This policy will address the three reserve funds. We have an operating reserve, about $3.5 million. Actually, it's in your packets. And I can slide to that really quick, because I think much of this discussion will focus on this slide here. Excuse me. There it is. You'll see the three red items to the left. That's what we're talking about in terms of the policy today. The operating reserve, $3.7 million, CIP reserve, nearly $20 million, and the Stage 2 capacity reserve of $13 million. All of the other money you see there is invested by either the bond documents, the overriding, you know, policy on those to make sure we have money provided for projects, or our working capital in green, which we manage ourselves. My office manages. We use a lot of LAIF for those investments, naturally, and that's been a very good result for us. So we're talking about the three on the left. Now, PFM, Leslie Murphy is here this morning, and she's here to answer questions, has helped kind of enact the policy. And what we do is, when we make policy changes, she and the team at PFM make sure they understand and document those policies so that they can abide within them. They do not exceed those policies. As a reminder, the goal was safety, liquidity, yield. Safety first, liquidity second. Yield is a third, and I think Commissioner Lieberman said it best, an asymmetric relationship of the other two. And I get that. So while that is certainly understood, what we have done is we have brought the policy to something that is, we believe, a bit more conservative. And I'll let Leslie speak to this page. In that circled box there, the red outline box, we have illustrated where LAIF is, where we are, and how we, I think, are more conservative than government code. So, Leslie?
Thanks, Matt. Well, you keyed it up nicely. And we won't have to go back to the beginning of the presentation, since you've all seen it a couple of times by now. But what we did add on this page, as Matt alluded to, was kind of an overlay of LAIF permitted allocation versus code versus what we're recommending for you. And I think kind of the takeaways for today, we haven't changed any of our recommendations from when we last met with you all. You know, they are very conservative recommendations, well within code limits, and even in many of these cases, lower than what LAIF allows in its portfolio. But we did talk over the Portfolio Strategies Group with its recommendations, and they're comfortable with kind of where we're at, giving the team enough flexibility to kind of add value within these parameters, but also provide you a certain safeguard and a level of comfort for the way that we're investing your funds. One thing that I did want to mention, again, is that these maximum allocations are just that. This is our portfolio management's tool telling them this is the maximum that you can allocate to each of these sectors. It's not a strategic allocation necessarily, nor is it a guide of where our actual allocations will be. It's just telling the trading room, based on market valuations and based on our view of current conditions and likely future conditions, this is as high as you can go, but we're not necessarily going to go up to that limit. One in particular I kind of wanted to mention, the commercial paper. You'll note LAIF can go up to 30% in commercial paper. Code is 25% limit. We're recommending a 15% limit. In all honesty, for most of your accounts, those longer 1 to 10 year targeted accounts, we likely will have a very small or negligible commercial paper allocation. We could see more in the operating reserve account because it's a shorter fund. Commercial paper has a max maturity of 270 days, so we could see a little bit more. But in similar accounts, I looked just the other night, we're looking at a 1 or 2% allocation. Now, that could increase, Given current market conditions, there's some value there in commercial paper. But just to kind of give you an example, these are max allocations, not necessarily a strategic allocation or a directive. If we move to page 11, this might kind of drive home that point a little bit more. So what we're showing on this page is a 1 to 5 year PFM sample portfolio. This is another kind of similar public agency account that we manage here in California. Looking back since 2012, these are kind of where our allocations were in that portfolio. So you can see the colors really change over time. Again, to sort of drive home the point that we don't set it and forget it, quote unquote. We're actively trading based on value, based on safety, and based on current and future anticipated market conditions. One that kind of jumps out at me, that negotiable CD, which is kind of shown in orange. Current allocations only 7%. 18 months, 24 months ago, current allocations were closer to 20% for that category. But we've dialed it back because we wanted to kind of get ahead of the markets a little bit and make sure our portfolios were appropriately allocated with liquidity, because these particular instruments are not as liquid as, say, traditional corporate notes or commercial paper. So we've kind of proactively scaled back that allocation from where we were 18 to 24 months ago. Moving ahead to page 12, this is just kind of another look at how our portfolio management team really thinks about relative value opportunities. We always look at the U.S. Treasury note as kind of our base case. You know, that's the quote-unquote safest security out there, certainly the most highly liquid. So anything else that we're considering buying within your policy parameters, we look at where is it trading currently relative to U.S. Treasuries and where has it traded historically. So kind of an easy example is federal agencies. You know, 7 to 10 years ago, a typical public agency portfolio might have about 70% allocated to federal agencies. Now that's dropped down in some cases to the single digits because they become expensive relative to treasuries. Now we're seeing a lot more treasuries in our client portfolios. And a similar story with asset backs and corporate notes. Again, we focus first and foremost on safety, secondarily liquidity, and finally yield. So if the yield advantage isn't there, you know, if these instruments are trading expensively relative to treasuries, we wouldn't buy. But again, we are asking for an increase in policy limits just to give us the flexibility to use these sectors and to potentially allocate a certain amount of your funds, but it's not necessarily a guidance, it's just an upper limit that we're asking for today. And then page 13, I think we've all seen this one, maybe one too many times, but this is again an example of the benefits of diversifying portfolio away from that fully 100% treasury portfolio to a more widely diversified portfolio, again, within the constraints of California government code. And over time, a $30 million investment in the fully diversified portfolio, that top line would have generated about $1.74 million in incremental earnings over the past 10 years versus just that treasury allocation alone. So this kind of speaks to, you know, why we're having this conversation, the potential value in incremental earnings to you all.
Thank you, Leslie. I think in summary, what I'd like to kind of wrap up with is to say that we're focusing this conversation on the three funds that I mentioned. I'd also like to compare it and do a little bit of emphasizing that, you know, what we are proposing is very consistent with other agencies. It's also something that I think is, you'll see it reflected in both LAIF. So when we place our money in LAIF, they have a similar type of portfolio. County Pool, they also have similar portfolios. So we are a kind of mid to longer term maturity, 3 to 5 years, depending on which of the funds we're talking about. But that's the purpose of this strategy, is to align ourselves and to make sure we are taking opportunity and advantage of the products that are out there. So with that, any questions?
Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you. Just a couple. One of which you sort of partially touched on, but let me ask it in a little bit different way. If somebody from them was here, if I were to ask LAIF why they only allow 0% maximum asset-backed securities and we're proposing to do 10/5, what would they tell me?
I'll probably let Leslie elaborate on this, but different liquidity measures. LAIF is instantly available. I can take it out tomorrow. So asset-backed securities don't lend themselves well to that. It's a longer type of strategy. But the county does have asset-backed securities in their pool. So.
And its policy, certainly.
And their policy, so.
Okay, so we're talking about liquidity. It's a liquidity-based thing, and LAIF tries to be extremely liquid.
Yes.
And we don't necessarily have to be quite as extremely liquid.
That's right. Ideally, we don't want to spend this money immediately.
Right.
We have it for, you know, years down the road.
And my second question, which unfortunately now is a great time to be asking this, how are your portfolios doing in the current economic, the current financial record?
Well, if you think about it in terms of total return, which is kind of how we manage accounts that look, and that looks at yield and changes in market value, you're looking pretty good because, you know, let's say when we bought a 2-year treasury for you, it might have been a 1%, 1.5% this morning. 25 basis points on a 2-year treasury. That means the securities that you're holding are at a much higher yield than current market yields. So if you had to liquidate, we're certainly not recommending this, but if you had to, you'd be sitting on some nice market value gains. So that's kind of the good news. We did have a lot of internal calls and also some kind of client-facing calls as well last week to kind of talk about the situation. And it is something we're currently watching, we're monitoring. We did take some steps just because there were some global growth concerns even, you know, late in 2019. We did take some steps to kind of look at our corporate holdings and to say, are we comfortable with where we're allocated right now? So what we did, we shortened the duration of our corporate holdings because we said, there's some uncertainty, things might move. Let's pull this a little shorter. Let's take another look. So the portfolios were already kind of taking a step towards those sort of, you know, more conservative stance. So we're going to continue to do that. We haven't made any major shifts in portfolios. We're still pursuing long-term strategies and a disciplined duration process. But our portfolio management team is very closely monitoring the situation, and we'll make changes if necessary.
Now, I would imagine, in my ignorance off the top of my head, the sort of risk exposure might be more on the coming out of the current problem. Because right now what you've got is, right, as people fleeing equities into something else, and we primarily, for other reasons, hold to something else, and so it's bidding up the prices, and it'll be an interesting thing to see how, from a risk management point of view, how you adapt to when things revert. Okay, thanks.
Commissioner Lieberman.
So thank you very much. I believe this was brought back again in part because of Belmont's concerns on this. So first of all, I would like to say thank you very much to city staff, to Silicon Valley Clean Water staff, for taking the time to meet with our staff. I've spoken with our finance director. He was very appreciative of some of the clarifications that you made, especially in terms of which monies would be subject to investment. And he is far more comfortable now with this policy, enough so that I'm going to vote to approve it today. That said...
Finally.
I need to get the right preamble. That said... and I do believe that the company that we're looking at working with, great track record. They're very, very good. Again, I'm not dismissive of any of their abilities, and this should hopefully be a very successful policy. However, I just need to state it for the record, just to make sure that to the extent it can come into any discussions on how does Silicon Valley Water proceed? I am absolutely insistent for Belmont, understanding that some of the other commissioners may or may not agree, and that's okay. Preservation of capital is extraordinarily important. I am absolutely convinced that when we begin, if we ever begin to lose money, that the negative ramifications of that from a public trust perspective are so great, I gladly give up any interest level to avoid that. And so it's just very, I have a very, very conservative approach when it comes to investment of public money. I do believe, and I understand that, you know, liquidity is maybe not as important here as it is for the city. That gives us a little bit of an option. We want to make sure we're not constrained on the city side. And Leif, we know, I would say, the one thing about Leif that we find very good is we are not putting a firm in a position where there is the potential of a conflict of interest from a financial perspective. And that's the one, of everything I'm thinking about, that's the one thing that I would say structurally we need to be careful, because if the company that we use to help us manage our funds, they know that they're under pressure to show they're providing value, which means providing some additional return, which naturally can lead to slightly more risk. And I just want to be very aware of that and very conscious of that, because it's nothing to do with the personnel, it's nothing to do with the policies, it just has to do with the structure invites the potential for a problem. I believe staff is going to be well focused on that, and we will hopefully avoid anything on that, but I just wanted to make that kind of clear. Thank you for giving me a chance to do so.
Thank you. I think that we all kind of agree on that. Commissioner?
Yeah, thank you. I think I understood what you said. I guess, Warren, but what I want to if we were to absolutely make liquidity and have no, that's basically putting it in an overnight lay fund. In fact, probably not even a lay fund, it's an overnight government bond fund. And I just want to make sure I understand that where you're coming from. Because I think it's, we'll have a vote one way or another. It's just that it seems to, I'm trying to parse what you're saying versus you're saying you're going to support the measure. Because yes. It almost sounds like you don't like it. And that's okay. You can vote however you like.
Well, so let me try to make this, as I'll try to clarify. There's the personal side of what I believe is true as Belmont's representative. There is the part of representing Belmont as an entity on this board. And my personal beliefs, if I let my personal beliefs take hold, I'm not doing the responsibility of a public official serving on this board. Okay? So, from a policy perspective, I've spoken with Belmont's finance director. We're comfortable that this policy is a good policy now. It's okay. We've gotten some clarifications, and I can bring myself to approve it. That said, I'm trying to impress on staff and on the board as well that there's definitely an asymmetry, from my perspective, because I don't know how the other members of the board, I don't even know how the other members of the cities feel on this. And, you may agree, you may not agree. From my perspective, especially as Belmont's representative, I've had a discussion with our staff, and I feel comfortable representing Belmont's position, as we are extraordinarily concerned with the preservation of capital. We believe that when an agency loses money because of an investment policy, it has the potential to erode the public's trust in that agency and lead to cataclysmic issues. Doesn't always, but we've seen government entities lose money. And it's been a problem. And so when I think about the benefits for the agency that come with increased interest and revenues, there's certainly some value there, but it doesn't get anywhere near to what I think is the downside if we were to lose money. And structurally, one of the things that Belmont, what we're doing is, because Matt doesn't have the bandwidth to actively manage the funds. Can't do it, right? You said that?
Yep. Well,
right?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. If we're going to do this, how do we do it? Now, one way is to give it to Leif, and Leif is managing a pool of money. They don't have, they have a responsibility, but I believe their responsibility is a little different than us going out and hiring an entity, any company that, for that matter, to do it, and there's a structural conflict there that gets me concerned. Again, we're doing it with a portion of our funds. We're taking certain mitigation strategies that if we do have a problem, it will be mitigated, which is good. But I do want to, I feel a responsibility as Belmont's representative to point out that structurally we're doing something that I'm not 100% comfortable with. Doesn't rise to necessarily voting against it, but I want to make it, so to speak, clear that there is a concern. Does that help?
Honestly, let's just go to the vote.
Is there anything else you want to say? If I may comment, I think last week is a good example of this. You know, I'm in the midst of building budgets, looking at debt strategies, focused on what are we going to do? And as that's happening, the market's going a bit haywire. Leslie and the credit committee team from PFM have immediately, they're taking steps to manage within the constraints. So I get a lot of comfort for that. I get a lot of confidence from that. That's one point. The second point is that the fees associated with PFM, it doesn't matter how many trades they do. It doesn't matter how much they yield. They're paid the same. They're paid a certain basis point, agreed upon fee, inner agreement, and that doesn't change. The only thing that they get is the size of our portfolio, they get more money, depending on how much more money we put into the portfolio. So, again, I would emphasize those two points as how I can, I think, it helps us achieve some of these goals, and it mitigates our risks somewhat. Not entirely, but somewhat.
Yeah.
Through the chair, mm-hmm. Just a very brief comment. I was thinking about stuff here. I remember years ago when I worked at Atlantic Richfield, I accidentally overheard the CEO at the time say that, I won't try and do the Texas accent, that he understood about high risk, high return plays and low risk, low return plays, but why didn't anybody ever bring him low risk, high return plays? And I remember sitting there thinking, like, because the whole point of market dynamics is they don't exist, okay, except sporadically. The challenge, I think, that comes in making any decision involving risk is that it's absolutely true that none of us in any one of our public capacities would like any of the agencies whose public money they manage to endure risk, or to have a negative outcome, a crash in the portfolio or something. The difficulty, of course, is that that's not possible. Kind of like the CEO didn't understand that wasn't possible. I mean, even Leif has a chance of having something go really sideways if things get bad enough. For that matter, even investing in overnight government securities has a problem with that. It's not as, that's about as riskless as you can get, but there's still things that can happen. So I respect the desire to want to have the best possible outcome. That's what we're trying to wrestle with. I think I'm reasonably comfortable, given the work the staff has done and the clarifications that they've made, that this is a sound and reasonable thing to do under the circumstances. And I just ask that you monitor it going forward, and if we need to make adjustments, come back to us.
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. All right.
I'll move approval if we're at that point.
Yes. Seconded.
All in favor, Bede?
Aye. Yes.
Any opposed? Okay, moving forward to 8B.
Okay, Kim will give this presentation.
Okay, thank you. Yes, so approval of MOU with SBWMA. This is an opportunity a long time in the making between SBCW and SBWMA. We've been discussing a food waste project for years. In 2014, we executed an MOU to collaborate. Since then, each agency has been going through the process of evaluating potential food waste technologies and opportunities and benefits, and we are at a point where we are ready to enter into an MOU to start delivering waste. This is a pilot facility at this point, and SBWMA is starting up their pilot facility with the intention to gather the data and build the infrastructure to go to a full scale if it turns out to be feasible. So this is a timeline of some of the regulatory drivers, the regulatory laws that have been passed over the decades. Certainly in the last 5 years, the regulations have gone towards diversion and greenhouse gas emissions reductions on the solid waste side. So these are kind of the drivers for SBWMA, specifically SB 1383 in 2016 required a 40% reduction in climate pollutants and a mandated diverting organics away from landfills. So the benefits to SVCW of a food waste, a full-scale food waste project, are significant. First being power generation, we see the ability for 2 to 3 megawatts of power that we can generate. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions is certainly within our goal of an agency to be a steward of the environment. It would reduce our PG, certainly that amount of power generated would reduce our PG&E dependence. Another benefit certainly is that SBWMA is our sister agency. We have overlapping service areas, board members in common, and we are motivated to help them meet their regulatory requirements. And potential in the potential to sell excess power and participate in the green power markets is another benefit as well. So this is an aerial of our plant, and the yellow box there is the existing facility that we've used previously to receive food waste from from the previous pilot that we had done. And this is all existing infrastructure we would receive in that location and pump the waste into our digester mix room to be digested. So I've shown a similar graphic to this, but this is the co-digestion process at Recology. They take the municipal solid waste, push it through an Orex press, a very high-pressured press, which then produces a lovely-looking slurry of organic material, which then gets trucked over to our facility, ends up being digested in our digesters, creating methane that we're able to used to generate electricity and support our electrical needs. So, as I said, we're looking to go from pilot scale to full scale. This pilot stage that's covered by this MOU will provide a lot of data that we need and experience to move us toward the decision to go to full scale. And in particular, how much more gas can we anticipate from going full scale? How many more solids will we need to will we need to dispose of as part of the process? And this will create data into our gas utilization study and provide information for how much we may charge in tipping fees as part of the full scale project. So the recommendation is to approve the MOU.
Christine, do I have any conflict? I am the chair of Silicon of SBWMA. I say vote yes, but I'm just. And I also voted it on the other board, so
oh,
move
you
this
did.
Forward.
And then, so that's an interesting question. You did. I'm sorry. You said you voted
you
on this previously.
Yes, support, yeah. And I'm the vice chair of that one.
Right.
But I could.
You know, this takes a majority vote, I mean, to be on the safe side,
we could
certainly
do it without my vote.
Yeah. That's
fine.
I think that would be good.
Through the chair, just as an aside, we should obviously follow the law, but I respect your ability to keep your two roles separate. I just wanted to say that I think this is a great pilot project. I really appreciate all the work that both staffs have put into this and look forward to it being successful so that we can consider spending even more money.
Thank you. So I agree. I think this is sounds like an excellent pilot effort. One question that I had, and I'm just not clear if I've missed it or not, but just if you could just clarify. If we go to a full scale, if things prove out, I'm understanding it could be a $20 million investment. I was just trying to get a sense of what level of savings or what revenue we are anticipating, even if it's going to be clarified by the pilot study. But I couldn't quite, if it was in here, I couldn't quite pick it up in terms of what are the benefits we're anticipating if we went to a full-scale effort.
In terms of dollars?
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm just trying to understand if we potentially are going to be thinking about a $20 million investment for mm-hmm. works, what's that going to be either getting us from the tipping revenue or saving from electric costs?
Right. That's a healthy discussion.
I think we'll let Arvin, our engineering director, he's leading up the effort, so I'd let him speak.
So there's two, there are two components of this project. One would be the receiving, which is there's a revenue stream from that receiving, which is in terms of tipping fee. And again, we are a sister agency, so our intention is to recoup the cost of treatment, receiving, and all that. So that should offset the cost. On the other side is the power generation. So once we convert that slurry into gas, that's the real benefit that we are trying to harness. And our preliminary assessment with working with a company has turned out that if we install 1 to 2 megawatt generators, it can pay for itself in about 7 years.
In about how?
7 years.
7 years.
So it has a pretty fast payback period. And after that, it's pretty much ours. In a power generation, because every year we have our power cost going more and more, and that is a conservative approach of 7 year payback. I would say, you know, it's a pretty pretty good kind of payback from that perspective.
Okay. So just again, I just want to make sure. So if it's going to cost us $20 million to build a plant, are you saying that we might be saving $3 million a year, plus we'll get revenues of some tipping fees, but not much? I mean, that's not really entering into the equation.
It would be close to $3 million. And just to give an example, our current cogen project, which generates about $1.9 million of revenue, it offsets $1.9 million. It cost us about $700,000 to $800,000 to generate that. So that offsets about $1 million to $1.2 million of cost of PG&E power cost that would have otherwise, you know, spent. That just gives a magnitude on a 1 megawatt of power. If we do to about 2 to 3 megawatt, it will probably scale up in the same range.
There's a healthy sort of balance between myself or friction even myself and Arvin when we talk about this issue, right? So we have a model, and the model is being fed in with information. The information that goes in will include the cost of us to support the pilot project, whether it's staffing costs or supplies or chemicals or additional hauling. All of that is going into the model. These are not small numbers, but they're going in. On the other hand, the benefits might include less electricity. You know, we're saving ourselves a lot of PG&E. The cost of capital goes in there, the cost of borrowing that capital. All of this is to say our target is about a 7-year payback, and it looks like it's achievable. There is going to be some associated tipping fees, and that will be the final kind of plug value, if you will, because that's the variable. If we can't achieve a payback, it's got to come from somewhere. Our ratepayers shouldn't have to bear the cost of this, you know, this change, but we want to do what's right by our sister agency. So that model will inform us a lot, and the pilot's going to help us get there, because right now it's kind of a guess.
Great. No. I think for me, I'm glad to hear that. Again, conceptually, this is makes sense. It's a good effort. I think I would like to be convinced that the economics of it do make sense. And as you come back later, you know, again, whether there's, you know, I don't know if there's going to be increased operational costs. I don't know if some of the equipment, you know, 7 to 10 years from now needs to get replaced. So, yes, there's a 7-year payback, but then you still have to kind of redo it. Or is everything kind of in place for 30 years?
Right.
And so from years 8 to 20, 30, we really begin to recoup
right. All
of that and kind of now generating something positive for that. So just sounds to me like the pilot study is well worth proceeding with. But as you proceed, it'll be really helpful to understand the economic analysis of this on a full scale effort.
Commissioner. Thank you. Can I ask you a follow-up question? So if we don't do this pilot project and conceptually didn't do if it plays out a upscale thing, from a greenhouse gas point of view, what does SBWMA have to do? Because they have that state law they have to comply with. And
so we have a representative from SBWMA right here.
I was going to introduce
them. I'm sorry.
I was going to introduce them.
Thank you for the opportunity.
This is Hillary Gons
from the SBWMA, and thank you all for your collaborative spirit on this project and your years of service with our agency, too. We're working with 4 other wastewater treatment plants. So this is a pilot project that we started with Silicon Valley Clean Water, but because of the volumes that we're generating, we're spreading our material out to other agencies. We'd like to work with the agency that has the most overlap, obviously, from a ratepayer standpoint, synergy, and also location. So this material will go somewhere. It will get turned into energy at one wastewater treatment plant or another. And this MOU and this work that we're doing collaboratively to understand the technical and the financial feasibility is important to getting to the next step.
Okay, thank you. I was asking a slightly different question, but let me phrase it this way. To me, if I understand it correctly, one of the overall system integrated benefits of this is that we will be reducing greenhouse gas emissions, right?
Yes.
And that's a valuable public good to get to. Not only it's also a requirement that we have from the state to some degree, but independent of that, it's a valuable good. And that makes it worth pursuing, assuming other things work out. And I hope that gets factored into whatever financial analysis we do, because it's a difficult to price thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, financial analyses can really only cover things that you can buy and sell, and there is no market for reducing greenhouse gas. And so it may end up being just a pricing thing. In other words, tip fees and whatnot is, if we want to do this to achieve a public good, how do we have the public pay for it? Okay. Mm-hmm. And I agree that our agency shouldn't necessarily bear, you know, subsidize that, but that's almost a question of who raises which rates in order to achieve a valuable public good.
To answer that part of the question, I think the regulation requires all the municipal solid waste agencies to divert a certain percent, and I believe it's 40% of organics, away from landfill. So the black bin stuff that had, according to state waste characterization study, they found 75% of the waste going into landfill has organics. And state, under the SB 1383, is mandating all the waste management authority, including, you know, such as SBWMA, that you must divert 40% of that organics away from landfill. And this is the effort. So that's on all the agencies that they have to meet. And this effort was also identified by the state, that you pair with wastewater agencies where these organics can be taken and beneficially utilized. So it has 2 benefits. One, it's going to reduce the fugitive emissions at the landfill. And the second, it's captured and it will be producing green power. So it's like it has a double benefit.
Yep. I didn't mean to imply that your answer was, it was a great answer, just I hadn't phrased my question right. So.
Great.
Do we have any permit issues, air quality?
We have a permit. We have a permit
for it already.
A permit for this pilot.
For the pilot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Will this have long-term? Will the full project have another whole round of permitting issues?
Oh, yes, it will. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If there are no other questions, I...
Madam Chair, I'll move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Abstain. Okay, and the last item is the presentation of fiscal year budget.
Thank you. So item 8C, so this is the first of two budget hearings here at SBCW. This will be brought back in April, so there's no action to be taken today. Having said that, like any year, this is the budget that we put together is an effort to balance risk and probability of that occurring. Certainly, there are things we know that we budget for every year. We know what our MOU includes. That's two-thirds of our costs. Is the cost of our staffing. We know more or less what the operational volume will be, how many solids we'll be hauling, etc. So those go into the budgets. We have a preventative maintenance program that we fund. That goes into the budget. That's something we've invested heavily in. On the other hand, there's uncertainties that are in here, what the price of PG&E will be, you know, in keeping with what we've just discussed. PG&E rates are announced, you know, towards the summer or later, and we don't yet know what those are. So we assume certain things in this budget. Then there's always the unexpected occurrence, you know, that something happens that we have to invest in or pay for. What we don't do is budget for a perfect storm. We don't budget as if everything's going to go wrong and we have a bunch of extra money for that. That's the purpose of reserves, and we'll use those reserves if necessary. So with that, the summary of the budget is on the slide in front of us, which is showing that compared to the 2019-20 budget, we are looking at a total increase of member contributions of 1.79%, including everything. The operating budget above in the first three rows comes to a net operating expense increase of 5.6%. We were able to reduce the amount of money that we spend on small capital projects. We call it revenue-funded capital, by nearly $400,000. And that's the result of just no large projects this year, which is fortunate. The reserve designation, you'll see that does substantially increase. That is a policy that was put into place, and that decision to increase by $500,000 per year each year is starting in this year. So we were $1 million per year for the past decade. Now we're going to $1.5 million. That was in our long-range finance plan. Our rates are built upon those plans, so I'm optimistic that that is not a surprise to any given member, nor their staff. And then finally, debt service. There's a reduction only because we had refunded some bonds in the past, and when we fixed the debt service payments, it worked into a one-time kind of a decline in debt service. So we're taking advantage of that next year. So at the end of the day, $860,000 and 1.8% increase in total cash flow to this agency. Following slide is when we like to keep an eye on how are we doing versus what we said in our long-range finance plan. And again, we are very close, within 1% of the total member contributions that were spoken of in January of 2019. So we find that encouraging, that each year when we refresh our long-range finance plan, we're keeping an eye towards how close are we going to be. So we're performing there. The budget itself, this is where we spend probably 80% of our time, is actually building, you know, the core of our proposed budget. And so this slide shows where, you know, we are seeing the increase or decrease in the personnel line, for example. 8.5%, that's the enactment of the total cost of living adjustments, our contractual obligations with our contract staff, our union here, as well as the other large items, which is utilities, electricity. We have a PG&E. We incurred a one-time billing adjustment, which, with the construction up front, long story, PG&E was not billing us accurately, and then they introduced here's a retroactive bill for a significant amount of time, and we are seeing that in this year's numbers. So you'll see where utilities on the budget is $1.7 million for this fiscal year. We're expecting the forecast to be closer to $2 million, so we're going to be over budget on that utilities line. Next year we don't expect that to reoccur. and we will not budget for that, and we'll continue to take advantage of CoGen and the improvement of that. So you'll see a decline there on the utilities line versus forecast. But budget to budget, a very similar type of number. Other things in there, we are seeing an increased permit fees from the State Water Board or for nutrient studies in the Bay. We are investing in some public outreach chemicals. There's negotiated price increases. And then the service lines, which is a food waste pilot. We have a little bit of money in there because we will sustain about $100,000, we think, in total cost to support this food waste. That can go into that model I spoke about, and we'll move forward from there. And then the Smart SOP program is it's kind of a staff training and a operating procedures electronification, if you will. So spending some money on that so that staff can, as we're hiring new staff, they are better able to understand how to service and maintain equipment and operate the plant. So there's some investment there. This slide is very detailed, but at the bottom line, you'll see the increase-decrease per member is a very consistent number. So it's telling us that, you know, where we apply the JPA-mandated allocation of costs across the membership, it's very consistent, unlike some years where we saw some very different type of numbers with allocations, but that was something I wanted to point out. The revenue-funded capital, $1.3 million. You'll see in here that all of these projects are needed for either safety or what I would call productivity of operations reasons. There's rebuilds of some Fournier presses, which is some dewatering equipment. There's rebuilds of generators to make sure our cogen engines run properly. We are replacing a dump truck that is really becoming a problem and hasn't been working for weeks on end sometimes. Replacing one fleet pickup, replacing some technology switches out in the plant that are at the end of their useful life, replacing lab equipment. And then we have a couple safety items, including a lifting crane for equipment work, addressing some pooling and puddling of water around a loading area that's a slip hazard, and some gate configurations for emergencies when we have someone coming in or out of the plant. So all of those come to $1.3 million, which, as I said, is less than is typically budgeted in this area. Cash reserves, there is the $1.5 million that goes towards the CIP reserve, and if you recall, a few months ago, we had approved the CIP reserve amendments or the reserve policy amendments, and we will continue to see CIP grow, and we think that, you know, in 10, 15, 20 years, we'll have a significant amount of money in the CIP available for projects that we'll continue to spend and will benefit from this policy.
I know I might have asked this before, but when we look at our reserve and we look at our... I know this last year we've been approving a lot of things that we haven't been repaired for 20, 30 years. Do we have a cycle? You know, it's like we know we have $24 million, but we know in 5 years... we might be using up some of that, and given, you know, the machinery and things like
we
that.
We do, and the CIP update that the commission approved in January reflects that.
A lot of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
and it does. What I liked about the reserve policy we addressed a few months ago was that as we build up the reserve policy, when we hit that target amount, at that point, the amounts we've been contributing will start to divert towards those ongoing projects that you've mentioned, yeah. So we'll have that ability.
Not only ongoing project, but updating the machinery and things.
Yeah, the yes. Replacement, the recurring replacement.
Yeah, the cycle, we'll call it that. Debt service payments are on this page. So you'll see the green box, shaded box, $19.6 million. You do, however, see that 2022, the amount goes up to $25.3 million. So we are in this one period where it's a certain amount. Now, these amounts are forecasted in our long-range finance plan, and your rates are built on top of these projects, these debts schedules. But I did want to point that out, that we are going to see some increase next year.
On that, any sense roughly of what the impact will be on the member agencies?
For debt service?
Or just overall in terms of rates?
So we have done the forecasting by member, and we look at, because the members have lifted their rates so considerably over the last decade, what we're looking at are modest increases across all members. I don't think there's a single member that's looking at an increase greater than 4.5% per year.
And that's even encompassing your jump to the $6 million
high. Yes.
Okay, that was the question I had. Thank you.
Now, debt structure. I did want to spend a couple of moments talking about debt structure here, because we're in this cycle right now where, on this slide, you'll see as of January 31st, the amount of money that is currently available for projects is around $339 million. And that assumes these four lines there. We have the WIFIA / notes transaction that we did around $200 million last summer. That's now about $150 million remaining. Cash contributions from members, those were in lieu of debt participation and for other reasons, but that's about $13 million. The 2018 bonds, which is earmarked for non-rescue projects, that's currently around $19 million. And then we're closing, knock on wood, very soon with the state on our SRF loan of $169 million. So the sum of those four lines is $339 million. That will last us, at the pace of current construction, somewhere between spring of 2021, at the soonest we'll be out of money on those projects, and then spring of 2022 for rescue. So the first thing to do is to make sure we have enough money for non-rescue. So there's a couple of strategies that I'm working on to help us along that way. But we will need around $130 million more to finish the current proposed CIP, as was defined a few months ago.
As an aside, given the financial rout that's going on right now and people fleeing into is it possible for us to pre-fund stuff?
Yes.
Because it sounds maybe a little counterintuitive to some people, but actually borrowing money if you need it in the depths of even a recession is not a bad idea.
So over the weekend, I had three calls from our financial advisor. He called me again this morning. It's like, best time is to issue bonds right now. He said, you wish you were Honolulu, because Honolulu Water is issuing bonds today or tomorrow, and they have the best luck of anybody at the moment, because the yields are extremely low, like record lows. And I have a couple charts in here. But the point is, you're right, it's an excellent time to issue new money.
Is that one of the things we're looking at?
Yes. So what I'm proposing is this debt strategy, next steps. Currently, I want to exploit low-cost funding. Certainly, absolutely. We want to complete our SRF negotiations. That's by far the cheapest source of money. Second point is we are in discussions with the EPA to negotiate additional WIFIA funding. That's also the second cheapest source of money. The EPA verbally has agreed to simply amend our contract from last summer and increase the size of the loan. So that means we don't have to go to market, we don't have to go through another credit review, it can simply increase the size of the loan with the stroke of a pen. I'm oversimplifying because there will be lawyers involved, but there will be an opportunity, we think, to take advantage of a very low-cost source of money. Now, the third one is, to Commissioner Olbert's point, pursue advantageous municipal bond market. It's a really good time to issue bonds. And so I'll be working and reaching out to your staff to say it's a good opportunity. We'd like your support on this. I know it's a super busy time, so I said to Robert, our financial advisor, this morning, we have to do the heavy lifting on this. I want to put it in front of the staff, but we've got a pretty current package that we did only 6 months ago. We simply need to amend it for one more year of financials, verify and validate the numbers, and then proceed from there. But it is an opportunity. The second large bullet on this slide is to say there's also an opportunity to do a refunding. We've issued bonds. We have a Series 2014 bond series out there, 2015 bond series. And we have a debt policy that says if we can refinance, like a refinance mortgage, we can refinance these bonds, we can save ourselves some money by taking advantage of the current market conditions. Now, the federal government changed the refunding law. They don't let us do non-taxable refunding anymore. That stopped about a year ago. But we might be able to do, we will be able to do, if the market sustains and holds, a taxable bond refunding, which keeps the IRS out of this, but it's still, you know, to us, it's just issuing bonds. They're just taxable bonds, but it could still save us a significant amount of money. So that's part of the equation as well.
Through the chair, I'll just make the observation that I'm pleased that our CFO obviously really loves this stuff.
I'm lucky enough to work in these market conditions. These are trying times for a lot of people, but this is a good opportunity for those of us who are borrowing money. This is an image of, as of Friday, what the market, municipal market, is looking like. You'll see that even the red line at 3% back in January of 2019, this is a AAA municipal market, 3% on a yield is really good, and that has declined to 1.5-ish over the last year plus. So continuing to see very good markets, and we'll take advantage of those. So here's the schedule. March and April, finalize our SRF loan. Maybe May and June, to finish those negotiations with the EPA. In the summer, submit the WIFIA letter of interest, perhaps, again, pursuing a new loan with the EPA if we would so choose. But in the meantime, and this might, that last box might be accelerated given the news of last week, spring to summer, pursue some additional public offering money so that we can lock in financing what are very active construction projects and finishing our CIP as planned. The calendar, no action today, but this is to provide direction. And in April, we'll bring this back for adoption, and then you'll be incorporating that into respective budgets in May and in June. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Madam Chair, I have probably about half a dozen, I think, fairly quick questions. Do you want me to just ask them all, or do you want to do round robin so you don't have one person holding the mic for too long? But
go ahead. How does the
commission feel? Go ahead. Thank you. Start with what I hope is a simple one. If the overall total member contributions are going up by just shy of $900,000 or 1.8%, there's a later chart that shows each of the component ones going up around 5%. I'm just trying to.
Okay. The 5% is the operating budget only. The 1.8% includes the contributions for capital and the debt service. So those are actually declining or are smaller.
Okay.
And the denominator changes along the way, too.
Okay. Got it. Thank you. Next one was on page, I think, 3 of the handout, anyway, 8C3, personnel costs, let's see. So $300,000 for organizational changes to support succession planning. Can you give us a little more color on that?
I'll tee it up a little bit, and I think Monty is here to express a little more. But the operations division, operations and maintenance under him, is looking at a significant amount of turnover in the next 5 years. We're talking supervisors and above. I think it's around 60% turnover, and a fairly young workforce underneath that. So the intent, I think, is to invest in. I'll let him put it. I'll let him explain it for you. So.
Yeah, the intent is to create temporary positions to allow that younger workforce to get that supervisory experience. Right now, with the current hourly employees being unionized in the operation and maintenance department, they can't perform supervisory, assigning duties and doing performance reviews and those things which are critical to those positions. So by creating a temporary position, we're able to move those people up into those positions, test them out to see if they have what it's going to take and further develop them. Otherwise, we don't have that ability to do it. And
it's hard to, we would much rather develop our people within to promote rather than go outside.
Thank you. That's, you know, a very clever idea. As long as we have the money, and I think we do, so thank you. That's good thinking. You probably had told us that before. It sounded familiar, and I didn't remember. So.
If I can add a little bit to that, our succession planning has really gone up quite a big notch because we do have a lot of retirements coming up. And unfortunately, we've had two people leave the agency, which is kind of unheard of. I mean, we have a really long retention. But because the commute situation is getting so bad and the ability to live in the peninsula area is getting more and more difficult, a lot of people are moving out towards the valley. So, part of what we're trying to do in succession planning is incentivize people to stay by promoting from within. So it's all part of it.
Just as a follow-on to that, and again, I applaud staff for thinking that kind of thing through. It may be appropriate, Teresa, for you to schedule a discussion with us about sort of generalized compensation policies, like given exactly the economic things you're talking about. Yeah. That's something I know San Carlos and I suspect everybody else is wrestling with, yeah. And we have to deal with that.
You read my mind. I do want to bring that to the commission okay. Next month or the following month.
Let's see. The admin expense increase of like just shy of $250,000, I see the two items for that are outlined here. Is there any color you can give us, Matt, on the remaining like half of that? Or is it all just little bits and pieces of things?
It was little bits and pieces. There are some timing matters as well, but nothing really jumped out, right, where I was looking at. And this is forecast, keeping in mind. So our forecast numbers are predicting certain things, and that's a variable. So unfortunately, I couldn't get yet one more big slug of information on that. Thank you.
On the proposed revenue-funded capital expenditures, it briefly caught my eye, $200,000 for network switches. You either have a lot of them or they must be unbelievably sophisticated networks.
We do have a lot, and these are hardened switches, which are an environmental type of industrial setting with gases and heat.
Right.
And,
right.
Yes.
Point.
Those
Sorry.
Are expensive.
On the same page was page 4, the last bullet point, it talks about the crane system going in. It certainly makes sense to me that it makes the mechanics' jobs easier and safer. How do we do it currently if we don't have a crane system?
This is new equipment that we've just installed, the rotary drum thickeners, and we haven't had anything down there that we've needed to get out of that area in the past. And now we're looking at putting in some cranes in order to be able to move that equipment and pull it out of the basement area and get it up into an area where we can come in and get it with forklifts. Right now, the only way we can do it is to rent a crane and come in through skylights
right.
And actually bring it up and out.
Okay. Well, that certainly, as I said, certainly makes sense. That reason alone. Are there other aspects of our planned capital improvement program where we're like, gee, we wish we had a crane here too? In other words, do we reflect back on that and perhaps tweak the forward capital plan to say, well, we need to increase expenses here because we really don't have a crane here? Or anything like that, sort of the support stuff.
Right. That's typically something that we look at in a capital improvement program is how we're going to maintain the equipment that we're putting in. This was a kind of a unique project in that it was a design-build project, and bottom line, just didn't catch the maintenance aspect of this.
But that's a learning opportunity also for future design build stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the design build is a great system, but that's one of the challenges of it is you're never down the bottom of the learning curve.
Right.
So, just a quick question on the dump truck used for biosolids transfer. Is it old or is it just the service life? The service is just much more heavy than we thought it was going to be.
I think we learned a lesson. We bought a used dump truck.
Oh, that's the used one you described elsewhere. Got it. Fine.
And that one has underperformed. So Monty says, please, no more used pickup or used equipment. So it is failing, and it's failing hard. And the new one would support as well.
Yeah, we've learned what we need to get her to do it.
Okay.
Fine. Great. Thank you for putting up with the somewhat detailed questions for this. That's all I have.
I just got one question. Matt, I just wanted to check. When I was I was somewhat surprised by the 8.5% personnel increase, and I don't know if I should not have been because I should have been more aware of it or not, but it took me a little bit by surprise, and I think, if I understand, roughly 70 to 75% of that seems to be related to what I'll call our contractual stuff. There's stuff that you're doing to prepare the organization for the future. You know, there's some planning stuff that goes into it, but
sure.
Roughly it seems 70% of that is related to right. Natural, this is what we've negotiated. As I look past next year, do you have any sense of, you know, are we going to see 6, 7% again increase in personnel, or is this a one-time? Because I don't remember, if I go back the prior years,
right.
Again, and my memory might be wrong, I don't remember 8.5% right. personnel jumps. And
right.
trying to just understand, has something changed? Can you provide some context?
Sure. So what we're looking at is a change of assumptions in some ways, but there is always... the MOU itself is the cost of living plus a step. And as we had a younger workforce, which I mentioned earlier, these people progress through steps A, B, C, D, and there's 5 percentage points between each of those steps. So that can add up fairly quickly. Now, they do top out. People top out after whatever G is, A, B, C, D, G, 6 years, and you'll have that kind of max. And then they'll be compressed to a 3.5% to 4% per year as they hit that max step. So that will, we're in this, you know, a fair amount of our workforce is still coming up through that max step. As they do, they'll stop growing at that. On top of that, and I think that's a change in assumption I was mentioning, we have a few more of those than I had anticipated. On top of that, we are seeing CalPERS contributions and the contributions percentage continue to grow. Faster than we had anticipated as well. And the organizational changes that we mentioned earlier, that's probably a full percentage point right there of just that organization change. So adding those up, I don't think this will be a continued, you know, 8.5 every year for the next 5 years. I really don't. In fact, our long-range finance plan assumes it won't.
And I think one of the things that will contribute to it not is as people retire, those people that are brought in are going to be brought in at a lower lower part of the salary range also. So that'll offset some of these other.
So what I would ask is, because I think our personnel is a fairly significant portion of our budget.
Mm-hmm.
If as we go through the year, you begin to see that, you know, next year we're going to see a significant jump or anything like that, I just ask, if you could bring it to the board's attention sooner rather than later, just even as a point of information, so
mm-hmm.
that we're preparing our own organizations on this.
Absolutely. Yeah,
thank you.
Through the chair.
Yes.
Just a quick follow-up to Warren's question. Roughly, what is the percentage increase you're seeing on the corporate contribution?
Let's see. So for the classic members, I believe it went from 21%. Of compensation contribution to 24, so that's a full 3 percentage points of increase of contribution.
Okay, which that's like, that's 10% of that. Yeah, that's a pretty significant, okay.
It is, it's a $300,000, $313,000 hit.
Kind of a simple question. Do you bill the agency's actual quarterly?
We bill monthly today, and how we do it is each year we budget and then we bill that budgeted amount.
Right.
At the end of the fiscal year, we do a true up and then we allocate that back to the members according to the actual flow and loading,
yeah.
So that the members' kind of net position is reflected with what they've actually driven through this operation. But the billing itself is based on budget.
So the number we're approving is, in fact, what we get billed quarterly.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. That's just procedural.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. And there's no action to take on this one today. And that brings us to environment. So we will see you next month. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.